Hello and welcome to the Gallery of Readers podcast. Today we get to hear from Norma Sims Roach, who recently retired from her work as an editor of college textbooks on biology and geology. She writes mainly memoir, personal essays, poems, and fiction based on true events, and some amazing descriptions of the local whitewater kayaking. Thank you so much for being here today, Norma.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So tell us, what's happening in your writing life right now?
Well, it's actually pretty quiet right now. I just retired this year, and so I've been kind of taken up with things like home maintenance and repair. But I'm really hoping that it's going to give me the freedom to spend more time on writing and take some more workshops and also spend a little more time reading good books, because I was, you know, reading technical stuff all day. I was lucky if I could read a cozy mystery. And I do miss reading other stuff.
Is there a book you've read recently that was particularly exciting for you?
Oh, I'm in the middle of one now that's called Juliet the Maniac. And it's a memoir of a young woman who was dealing with mental illness in her teens. And some review of it that I saw made me think that the structure would be interesting for a source for some of my things that I like to write about, youthful shenanigans.
Yeah. So is things like writing about youthful shenanigans and writing that comes from the heart, is that part of why you write?
Oh, yeah. I think you know, there's the cliche, writers have to write. And I know that isn't really me, because I can go for a long time without writing anything. But I think I do it because I have the impulse to tell stories. I think writing may save my friends from an excess of stories when I'm socializing. It's just to connect with the reader or the listener, to see them, be seen by them, give them something they relate to, make them laugh or cry. Or there was this one time that I went to an open mic that a Greenfield group put on for Valentine's Day, and it was, the theme was love and heartbreak. And I wrote a story based on a dumping in high school that I experienced. And at the end, the audience went, boo. That was such a great moment that I conveyed this feeling that I'm sure every teenager's had.
Wow, that's so meaningful. What would you say to your readers if you could say something to them?
Oh, it's basically thank you for reading or listening, because there's so much writing out there, and I'm just thrilled that you chose this to listen to.
Oh my gosh, I love your work. I love the way you describe things, and you always keep the heart right at the center. How do you write things?
How do I write? I think mainly I just tell what happened. I know there's a quote like that. I couldn't find it, but as soon as I saw it once, I knew that sounds like it. So I'll be telling a story, and as I go through writing it and then revising it, I'll see points of connection between parts of it, and or meaning, air quotes, more than I realized at the start, and it gradually takes shape into something a little more than just a story told at a party.
I like the way that sounds like a gentle growth, almost like an incubation process.
Yeah, I guess so.
That's cool. Like you feed it and it comes alive.
Yep. Matures, kind of.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Hey, okay. Oh, my pleasure. Thank you. A picnic in the woods. It was early May, and a stretch of warm, sunny weather was making sitting in class unbearable. So my friend Deb and I decided we needed a day off from school. I suggested visiting the old cranberry bog complex that our town had been arguing about. It was boom time on Cape Cod, and there was a proposal to build a subdivision there. But some people thought the land was unique and wanted it preserved. Deb and I agreed that we'd like to see it before it was gone, and that it would also be a great place for a picnic. So I packed all the essentials that young women of our time and place would need for a delightful day in the woods, some wine, some marijuana, and some chocolate chip cookies. To avoid the inconveniences of package stores and fake IDs, I'd made the wine myself. Here's the recipe. Take a 1 gallon plastic milk jug, well washed and rinsed, and in it place a small can of grape juice concentrate, a cup of sugar, and a package of yeast. Then fill with water. Place a large balloon over the mouth of the jug and put it aside in a dark place to age and mellow for 3 weeks, hoping that the balloon doesn't pop and send its strong yeasty odor through the house. Deb had a souvenir wineskin that held about 1/2 gallon, which I filled. The cookies I baked from frozen batter and the weed, well, we always had weed. In the morning, we met up at the corner store and rode our bikes to the old bog. A chain bearing a no trespassing sign stretched across the unpaved entrance road, so we walked the bikes around it and hid them in the bushes. The place was even more beautiful than I'd imagined. Around every corner was an abandoned bog or a little gem of a pond, all of them connected by a running stream. We explored all morning, stopping now and then to admire a view and discreetly puff on a joint, but we didn't see another human being. Wild cherry and plum blossoms brightened the familiar collection of scrub pines and oaks, and the sun and the freedom of the day lightened our hearts. As we sat down for our picnic and pulled out the wine, we thought we heard the crunch of car tires on the sandy soil. Who would be driving in here? We weren't too worried. If we weren't supposed to be here, then nobody else was either, right? But we decided we'd better keep moving. I tucked the wineskin under my white peasant blouse and we turned down a road heading deeper into the woods. But the sound of the car followed us. As soon as it came into sight, the logo of the town police department was obvious. We kept walking nonchalantly until it pulled up beside us. "Afternoon," said the cop. He looked slightly familiar. His name was Red, although we didn't know it at the time. "Afternoon to you. Beautiful day, isn't it?" said Deb, always the better talker of the two of us. "Sure is," said Red. "You girls wouldn't be skipping school now, would you?" "Oh, no," said Deb. "We're ecology students at the community college. Our classes are done for the year, so we thought we'd come over and see what kind of plants we could identify." As she spoke, I felt a damp sensation on my chest. I was clutching the wineskin and trying to look casual. It occurred to me to offer Red some cookies, but I didn't think I'd better move my arm. "Oh, I don't think so," said Red. "I know you," and he looked at me. "You belong to Bob Sims at the hardware store, and you," he looked at Deb, "are Laura Cottrell's daughter. I think I'll give them both a call when I get back to the station." And with that, he turned the cruiser around and disappeared down the dirt road. Deb looked at me and cried, "Oh my God!" "What?" I looked down. The wine had leaked out of the skin and made a big purple patch on my shirt. oh my God, it's all over you. How could he not have seen that or smelled it? And then he would have found the weed, and then we would have been really screwed, I replied. Not that I wasn't already. We walked back to our bikes in a more somber mood. When we got home, we found that Red had indeed called our parents. Deb's mother told her, Deborah, I understand if you need to take a break from school now and then, but if you do it again, I want you to tell me so that I'll know where you are. My mother gave me a more traditional bawling out. But much later, she told me that the cop's name was Red. Actually, it was Walter Lumbert, that he had been in her high school class, and that he had always been a kind of a pill. So all was well in the end, pretty much. I guess it shows our village cared, even if it didn't feel like it at the time. The town eventually preserved the old bogland as a wildlife sanctuary, and it's still there today. But I know that isn't how things always go. Not for places where a recession doesn't come along to slow down economic development, and not for kids the cops don't know personally, who they don't see as mischief makers from decent families who can be let off with a warning. And you couldn't say that Deb and I were reformed by our encounter. There would be many more adventures in our young lives, but we didn't get caught again. February is the new April. 60 degrees is more than warm enough for a phase change in the snow. What was once soft, white, gently piled, then brittle, gray, seemingly permanent, now breaks down, weeping ever more profusely as the sun climbs. The tears run downhill, gather at the low points. We who know this gather too at the Iron Bridge at noon. The river's rising as our kayaks launch. The water is liquid but hasn't warmed. All around us is the clacking of ice chunks jostling one another in our boats as fog rises into the warm air. It's as if we're paddling in a punch bowl filled for a toast to Mother Earth. As the water piles up and trips over itself, we run down the rapids cautiously or giddily, surfing, spinning, or simply staying upright, but always alert for the biggest chunks of ice. We pull over to the bank as if they were ambulances, carrying old man Winter headlong downstream, resuscitation efforts all in vain. Once we've passed the last waterfall, we drag the boats up the muddy bank, tie them to car tops and head for home, exhausted but no longer thirsty. The radio says that today set a record high and calls it an ominous sign. We nod to the sentiment, but turn the dial. Today is about loving what is. Tomorrow we'll go back to trying to fix it. We switch to the jazz station and sing along with Ella. What floats your boat? The fact that an object less dense than the fluid that it's in will float on that fluid is the principle of buoyancy. If the buoyant object is a whitewater kayak and the fluid is a river, then where the boat goes, whether it stays upright, and how much fun its occupant has also depends on the fluid's velocity and volume. That is, how much water there is in a river and the speed at which it's flowing. We paddlers are familiar with these principles, even if we don't know them by name. The U.S. Geological Survey, with the help of your tax dollars, has set up gauges on streams all over the country, and those gauges are now connected telemetrically to the internet. So rather than driving all the way to a river only to find it dry, you can go online and see what the water level is. For example, as I write this, during a drought, the Lower Millers River, the one you see if you're driving east on Route 2, has 2 feet of water in it, not enough to paddle. An amount of water that's barely paddleable is called a bony or scratchy level. Most paddlers prefer more water than that. But early in my paddling career, I went on several trips with a leader named Charlie, who seemed to enjoy bony levels. He knew all the rocks that he could wind between on the local rivers in all their tiny side channels, through which we learned not to follow him. Once he was guiding a group on the section of the Westfield River that we call Pork Barrel, from Cummington to Chesterfield Gorge, at a water level of 6 inches. Charlie was getting along just fine, but I kept hitting and getting stuck on rocks. By the end of the trip, I was feeling like I'd done poorly, until Charlie said, "Hey, you've really got the hang of getting unstuck from rocks now." That skill still comes in handy, and I still think of low water as Charlie level. So I now know that Pork Barrel needs a minimum of 6 inches of water to paddle. But that doesn't mean 6 inches is enough water to paddle any other river, because it depends on the size and shape of the riverbed. Pork Barrel is a smaller stream than Lower Miller's, so 6 inches of water is enough to get you through it, though 1 or 2 feet is a lot more fun. 3.5 feet is scary huge, so I'd probably skip Pork Barrel at higher than 3 feet. But 3 feet is the minimum level for the Lower Millers. Paddlers really hope that the water will rise above the bony level to the point where obvious rapids form. That is, where there's enough water to interact with the rocks in interesting ways, and for us to interact with them in ways more fun than hitting them, catching eddies, surfing waves, or splatting, which is sliding up onto a rock on purpose, under control, and is great practice for dealing with a rock you can't avoid. That amount of water is what we call a nice fluffy level. If your skills aren't strong, you may not want to paddle at a pushy level. On the Lower Millers, that's about 4.5 feet. As the amount of water in a river increases, so does its speed. So while the higher water level may cover up more of the rocks, if you do hit one, you're going to have less time to react, and you're going to hit it harder. And more dangerously, the greater force of the water can pin you against a rock or any other obstacle. I grew up near the ocean playing in the waves, but I never imagined how much power moving water could have until the first time I got pinned between a rock and a canoe, and literally didn't have the strength to get out from between them. Then there are extreme highs or flood levels. They can be deadly for casual paddlers who don't realize that the water they're looking at is higher than normal, which is a good reason to paddle with someone who knows the river. But highly skilled and experienced paddlers may take flood events as a challenge. One of those paddlers posted a helmet cam video of his run down the funnel, the biggest rapid on the Lower Millers, at a 6-foot level. The video, set to loud heavy metal music, showed the rapid filled with giant waves and gaping holes. The paddler commented, "I had to put that music in to drown out my voice, because every time I came up to one of those waves, I was going, 'Holy fuck! Holy fuck!'" My own paddling skills have never reached the holy fuck level, and as the years go by, it becomes less likely that they will. But I'm still dreaming of getting on some moving fluid next summer on a nice fluffy day. A friendship bracelet never taken off. I don't like something hanging from my arm, but this one stays in honor of its weaver. She made them for us in our chosen colors, me, Mama, Grandpa, Dad, and little brother. But it's her Mama's hands I see as mine pull clinging yellow fruit from homegrown peaches, the ones they gave us when we left for home. Hands golden browned and agile, working quickly as juice drips down her wrist and chained with thread. I lost my bracelet somewhere in my garden, but strings still bind all those who love its maker. who nourish giggles, tears, and future dreams, to grow a woman from a little child. No cheap date. I recently spent two exciting, exhausting days in Boston, courtesy of a famous movie star. I was picked up at my door by a limo, spent the night in a luxury hotel, had the choice of any restaurant I wanted to go to, and it all began with a dream. The generous gentleman was Michael J. Fox, and I'm participating in a medical study supported by his foundation for research on Parkinson's disease, which he's lived with since 1991. I had the dream that started me on this path some 20 years ago. As my domestic partner slept peacefully beside me, I dreamed that I was standing under a tree branch, on the tip of which hung a huge, threatening lizard. I moved my arm to whack the lizard to the ground and woke in shock to realize that I'd smacked my partner in the face. I cried out an apology, but in the disorientation of the moment, called him by my ex-husband's name. My sweetie forgave all, but as these nighttime incidents kept happening, we decided it was best to sleep separately. Now I would leap out of the way of a monster in a dream and find myself on the floor with my head ringing. A sleep study found nothing wrong. Eventually, I stumbled upon the fact that wailing on one's bed partner was a thing. It was called REM sleep disorder, and it was not only a hazard to sleeping sweethearts, but also a strong indicator of risk for Parkinson's disease. Not long after that, I saw an appeal for participants in the Parkinson's Progression Markers Initiative. The study wanted people with, without, and at risk for Parkinson's, from whom it would extract detailed medical data to compare. Maybe, I thought, joining the study would be a healthy outlet from my worries about developing the disease. But the decisive factor was that the foundation would provide transportation to the Boston Medical Center. I live in Western Mass, and I do not drive in Boston, my reasons for which could fill up another essay. So once a year, I find myself speeding along the Mass Turnpike in the back seat of a shiny black car, just like a state legislator. My driver drops me off at the medical center, where I'm met by a research assistant and an RN who will guide me through the rooms and departments where I'll leave various bits of myself. I'm lucky enough not to have been hospitalized since I had my tonsils out in 1960, so all of the procedures have been new and interesting. I've always loved reading about science and medicine, and I have no problem with needles. I was terrified of them as a child, but taking up whitewater kayaking has toughened me up considerably. I figured whatever they were going to do to me couldn't be worse than flipping my kayak in a rocky rapid, right? There were definitely hard parts. Keeping my head still in a banging MRI machine for over an hour took a level of concentration that navigating rapids has rarely tapped. To distract myself, I tried doing an arithmetic problem in my head that had been on my cognitive test that morning. I got different answers on different tries, but that was okay. The mental distraction, not the answers, was the point. The sight of the biopsy on my shoulder was sore for a while, though it probably took only about as much skin as I'd lost from my knuckles in the funnel rapid. And my first ever spinal tap sent intense cramps shooting up and down my leg. After that, I took the advice to stay well hydrated more seriously and barely felt subsequent ones. But hey, the study provided a $70 allowance for meals per diem, courtesy of Michael J., and who says no to free food? I barely touch that money most times, since the hospital cafeteria offered a unique hot ethnic dish each day for just $15. And throughout the day, the study team hustled to bring me snacks and beverages as if I was a rock star backstage. It wasn't until my first two-day visit, when I spent the night in the hotel, that I realized that a $70 allowance might not be outrageous. It was there that I had my first encounter with a $24 burger. At least it was a very good one. Another challenge of the study is the reminders of what might be coming for me. For example, I don't think I did well on the smell test. All the scratch and sniff patches smelled vaguely fruity to me. And loss of smell can be an early symptom of Parkinson's. The study is now developing a system that will allow participants to get their individual test results if they want to, a practice that's rare among medical studies. The researchers have already found a protein that appears only in people who go on to develop Parkinson's, so it may be possible to predict it soon. I'm pretty sure I'll opt to get the news. If I'm likely to develop the disease, I want to scout that rabbit before I run it. All in all, participating in the study has been a good experience and a contribution I'm glad to make. The information it's finding out from us will benefit many people, some of whom I know and one of whom I might be. And I'm grateful to Mr. Fox for making it all possible.
Everybody, if you want to read more of Norma's work, you can find some pieces up on the Gallery of Readers website, galleryofreaders.org. And while you're there, maybe share a little abundance, because we are a nonprofit and we thrive through this community. We would love to see you at a reading, or hear about a book you're enjoying right now, or hear about an author that we should feature on this podcast. So please be in touch. You can email us at galleryofreaderspodcast@gmail.com, and we would love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back soon with another local author. Until then.